Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for joining us in offering merit to those in need. The transfer of merit ceremony, I love the ceremony because we're offering. And this is something we do every day. We offer. We offer the merit, which is the goodness, in a way of speaking, of all our actions to all beings. Reverend Master Ji used to speak about sanctifying the mundane by approaching our daily routines with the mind of meditation and the mind of offering. We're doing this as an offering. It helps me to remember that. We're not doing it as an achievement or to get a paycheck. You know, we're doing it as an offering. Yeah, we may get a paycheck, but it's an offering to all beings. So, I just got back from a couple of weeks at a hermitage. Thanks to everyone who made that possible. It was wonderful out there, lots of wildflowers, birds, butterflies. The deer returned on the next to the last day I was there, the deer returned. So that was nice to see them again. But I just returned a couple of days ago, and I'm still gearing up to the pace of life here, which is a little faster than it was at the hermitage. We think of a monastery as a peaceful place, and it is. I think some people may have an idea of a monastery where everyone just sits like this and doesn't really do too much or does everything very slowly and deliberately. And that's not, you know, it is a peaceful place, and there's a lot to do. It's true everywhere that there's a lot to do. So sometimes there's so much to do that it can seem overwhelming. To me, anyway, I find that. The to-do list just gets so long, one realizes not all those things on there are going to get done. So sometimes there's so much to do, it can seem to challenge the ability to keep to the path of practice. And that's what we're here for. That's why we're doing these things. It's the path of practice. It's not checking off each and every single item on that list by the end of the day. It's keeping to the path of practice. So over these past few months, there's been a lot to do. It's been a time when it's been a pretty active time in the monastery. So I've been reflecting on ways of keeping my Dharma practice uppermost throughout all this activity. And offering the merit of all that we do to all beings, wherever they may be. And that really helps if I remember that I'm not doing this for some reason of my own. I'm doing it for the benefit of all beings everywhere. That helps. That's uplifting. So the title I gave to this talk is What to Do? And it has a question mark after it. My computer wouldn't accept what to do with a question mark after it as a file name. It would not accept any file name with a question mark in it. So I fooled it. I wrote what to do hyphen question mark with words. So what to do? In a monastery, quite often the job of answering this question, what to do for the community and the congregation, falls to the abbess or other senior officers of the monastery under the abbess's direction, relieving us of the necessity of making numerous tough decisions. The monastic schedule also relieves us of this necessity. So we could say, what to do? Oh, it's 8:45, time for breakfast, and that takes care of that. But outside the monastery, the days are filled with what to do moments. the monastic schedule, the abbess and the senior officers of the monastery give us this great blessing of having a lot of these things taken out of our consciousness even. However, at the Hermitage, it was a little bit different. I was the only one out there, so there was nobody to help me by making things, you know, telling me what I was going to be doing that day. And I didn't make a schedule for myself. I deliberately don't make a schedule for myself when I'm at the Hermitage. I mean, some days I do set times for sitting and working and so on, but generally there isn't a formal schedule. So I really had an opportunity to catch the dithering mind at work. Every day was filled with these little decisions. What to eat for lunch? Well, whether I should even have lunch or wait till later and just have a big snack. Or if I had a snack, then what would I have for it? But if I had lunch, I'd have something different. And what would that be? What to do next? Shall I go for a walk, maybe? Or shall I go outside and do some woodwork? Shall I go for a walk? Well, let's go for a walk. Okay. On the dirt road, the gravel road, or on the trails? And it's silly to look at it now. And out there, these things can assume an importance that might bring up a little bit of worry. I could find my mind getting into a little bit of a knot about whether to have lunch now or later. So I have to let go of that. You have to sort of take a deep breath and let go of that. Because in the long run, what difference did it make if I ate lunch now or later? And I have to ask myself that. Okay. So in the monastery, though, even though we have these great blessings of the abbess and the seniors and the schedule, we still have to make a lot of decisions every day. And above all, taking care of what we do in our spiritual practice. Because that's coming from in here, in here, in here. And only we can do our practice. We can certainly benefit from the guidance of those senior to us and the wisdom of the teachings that have been put out through the years. And we need to do this work of training with the mind. It's our, you know, the mind is here. So what to do with our minds? It's sitting on the cushion when we meditate. The meditation instruction really has all the information in it. Neither trying to think nor trying not to think. Neither grasping nor pushing away. Just sitting with no deliberate thought. Allowing the thoughts, feelings, emotions, opinions, all those things, reviews of the day's news, whatever, just to allow them to come and pass. Simple, right? Simple, not easy. So we go about our day here in the monastery, and the question becomes what to do when we feel that circumstances and other people are driving us crazy? Because that's how it tends to be for me when there's so much to do and so little time. I can begin to feel that, especially, you know, not so much the other people, because I've learned enough by now to know that it's up to me and it's not the other people who are driving me crazy. The circumstances, though, I can tend to feel that, well, if only I didn't have so much to do, that could, you know, I would feel a little more sane. So what to do? One of the initial inspirations for doing this talk came from three encounters I had with the word doer. The first two times the word was used describing venerable senior monks of our temple who were either describing themselves or somebody else was describing them as a doer, someone who was a doer. Well, the third time I heard it was I was looking at a news article online and I saw an ad for the Chevron Oil Company, which said, "We are doers." The first two times I heard it, this really pushed my button in terms of a koan of inadequacy. because my first thought was, of course, this button is my conditioning that's been with me for a long time and doesn't stop to think at times. Okay, I'm not a doer. Therefore, I'm inadequate. I need to be more like these other people if I want to be a good monk. But I'll never be like they are because they have more energy than I do. They know how to do more things than I do. How can I be a doer when I really don't know how to do very many things? So on. Then I was presented with the word doer in terms of an oil company. And I looked at that, and it just flipped to the other side of the coin. Here I am. Well, I'm not a doer who's always busy polluting the environment and killing the planet. Everybody ought to adopt a more laid-back attitude and be just like I am. And then the planet would be just fine. And so that was a great exercise in watching the mind and being with the mind as it did this complete flip-flop. Isn't that interesting, you know, what it can do? And thank heavens for our meditation practice, because that's what allows us to be able to watch the mind and help it not get stuck in our old conditioning. So, but meanwhile, I went through a time of mental and emotional agitation while knowing that it was mental and emotional agitation and resolving to train my way through it. Our practice gives us presence of mind to take a step back, take a deep breath, and recognize what this is that's happening. That's the first, for me, it's a very helpful first step to recognize what's happening. When I go through these mental and emotional storms, they remind me of going through a hurricane, because I lived in a hurricane place for a while, a place subject to hurricanes. And one time, a big hurricane came and hit directly where I live, pretty much. And so what I did during that hurricane was I was prepared for it, I recognized it, and I took refuge in an interior room, which is the strongest part of a building, an interior room with no windows, and I sat still there. And while the hurricane was there for, 3 hours or 2 hours, I don't remember now, but while it was there, it was roaring, shrieking, howling. It sounded as if battering rams the size of some of our large trees out there were being used against the building. Things were crashing all around. It sounded like, you know, very large things were crashing. I resolved to sit still there, though, because the information one gets is not to go out. Whatever you do, please don't go out. And until it's over, until you get from the media the all clear, whoever is in charge of these things in the government gives the all clear. And this reminded me of taking refuge in a karmic storm or a mental and emotional storm. We withdraw within into the strongest part, and I don't want to take the analogy too far, but into our heart of meditation. We withdraw within and sit still. And this storm can be howling, shrieking. A great description of it is in The Life of Asia, the portrayal of the attack by Mara of the Buddha when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree. Howling, shrieking, tempting, crashing, banging, whatever. So we're withdrawing within and taking refuge in something greater than ourselves, greater than our personality, opinions, and conditioned habits. We all have conditioned habits, whether we want to or not. They start happening, who says, from how many lifetimes ago, and certainly in this lifetime, from infancy, when our parents, our culture, the TV, our teachers, our schools, on and on, begin conditioning us in certain ways. And it's hard to see those things in ourselves. It's kind of like trying to see your own face. It's there, but you don't see it. So when we pay attention, attention is really a great word too. Paying attention or giving attention. I like to think of giving attention. It's a gift. So by giving our attention to the circumstances, what's arising from within and what's going on outside of us, there's an awareness there that's deeper than the thinking, feeling, and conditioning. It's an awareness that something's going on that needs attention. And so we can ask from that awareness what to do, what needs to be done. So in this particular case of the inadequacy pride situation showing up and kind of really pounding on me a bit, I started thinking about the judgmental mind with a contemplation. A contemplation is related to a meditation. It's not the same thing because one decides to take something and hold it up and let the thoughts contemplate that thing, that issue. So I asked the question, okay, I'm not a doer, I'm inadequate. Or I'm not a doer, that's good because I'm not doing as much harm as people that are running around being busy all the time. So I asked the question about me not being a doer. Is this true? Is it even true? So I imagine then sitting down at the end of a day and making a reverse to-do list. And it went on and on and on, the things I had done that day, starting with getting up in the morning, getting dressed, you know, going to meditation and morning service, taking care of the cat, eating breakfast, answering emails. How many emails were there? Listening to phone, answering phone calls and voice messages. I mean, it just goes on and on. So there you go. Am I a doer? Certainly, I was doing all day. I cannot tell myself I'm not a doer and therefore I'm worthless, or therefore I'm great. Neither one works because I do things every day. And even when I'm maybe not able to do as many things as I might wish, I'm still doing things in my practice. I'm watching the mind and sitting still and choosing to keep to the precepts, doing things. So, was it true? No. Even at the thinking level, the thought of being not a doer was not true. So now go deeper. I didn't want to stop there. I knew that wasn't as far as I needed to go with this issue. More important, the spiritual alarms were going off in terms of an intuitive awareness that's recognizing this, that this, I'm suffering, and the suffering is pointing to something in training. The first teaching that the Buddha gave, the first noble truth, is the truth of suffering. Suffering, the cause of suffering, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. So this suffering is pointing to something. When I hold still and let things settle, it turns out it's not about being a doer or not a doer or anything like that. The problem is the attachment to I am or I am not. This is the problem. The attachment is this, and for people, anyone who may be listening to this online, I'm holding up my hand and grasping something. I'm just holding up my hand and imagining an imaginary thing in the air and grasping it with a tight fist. This is the attachment to being me, who is this or that or the other thing. The second truth that the Buddha taught is grasping at desires is the cause of suffering. That's one way it was put. I was referring to a wonderful book at the Hermitage called The Sound of Silence by Ajahn Sumedho, who was a Western, a Western Theravadan monk who was the abbot of a Theravadan monastery in England for a long time, who trained in Thailand in the Thai forest tradition. So I was looking at this book, and I just found gems in there all the way throughout. And one of them is the way he put the second noble truth, the cause of suffering being grasping at desires, that not desires themselves are necessarily the problem. It's when we get them like this, grab them, and hold on to them. In my case, maybe it was the desire to be more competent, more capable, more energetic, so I could be a doer and help this temple the way those other people did. Something like that. That was the first thing. So it's the attachment to grasping a separate, continuous personal identity, which is another teaching of the Buddha's, anatta, or not a separate self. It's not that we don't have a self, a body, a mind, all kinds of components. It's that we are not this self. It is not a permanent thing. It is not a separate thing. It's connected to everything. And it's not something that we can cling to. So when we try to do that, it's causing us suffering. So the question goes right back to what to do to help this suffering being who's still kind of agitated about being this or being that. Is it good to be this or bad to be this? So going on, taking refuge in the Dharma, the word doer reminded me of some specific teachings where it appears. The first one is from the Theravadan tradition, from a scripture called the Visuddhimagga. And please forgive me if it's not really a scripture. It may be a commentary. I'm not that learned, so. But a work called the Visuddhimagga in the Theravadan tradition, which says, "No doer is there who does the deed, nor is there one who feels the fruit. Constituent parts alone roll on. This indeed is right discernment." So constituent parts, I think, you know, I wonder if there's maybe a different translation that doesn't sound so much like a machine. But our body and our mind and our consciousness and our, it's all made up of parts. Earth, water, fire, and air. Form, sensation, thought, activity, consciousness. These are all the constituent parts that it's referring to. But I do like the term constituent parts alone roll on, which means that our actions have consequences in the future. Our attitudes that we cling to continue to go on. And, you know, giving us a good reason to work on helping them now and not passing them on to some other being. So this teaching, no doer is there that does the deed, nor is there one who feels the fruit, points to realizing that the personality view, the me as my separate self, who is this or that, short or tall, a doer or not a doer, good or bad, isn't the essence of being. Reverend Master Dai Zui, the late head of our order, for anyone who doesn't know, used to call our self a convenient fiction. It lets you go down and get a driver's license, drive a car. It has a certain name on it so that not anybody can just get in the car and pretend that they're you and drive the car. You have to show the DMV that you can drive. And so, you know, you can go to the bank and they put out your ID and they give you your money, not somebody else's money from their account. But, you know, so it helps us get through daily life with all its myriad details. And it's not the essence of our being. I sometimes forget that. No doer is there who does the deed, nor is there one who feels the fruit. That means, the fruit means the consequences of our actions, whether for good or for suffering. That doesn't excuse us from being responsible. No one feels the fruit. We still need to take care of what we do, so that doesn't excuse us from that, to keep suffering from rolling on to harm other beings. And doing that, paying attention, giving attention is really important. All throughout this, giving attention to what we do. Cats, the last couple of cats that I've lived with in the last years have both been great teachers on giving attention, because they were both cats that were social and asked for attention. They don't just sit in the corner and let you do whatever it is you want to do. usually it's working at the computer, doing something in my room, working at the computer, doing some monastic office work or something like that, writing up this talk, whatever. And sometimes the cat wants attention. And various techniques they use are, if I'm typing, to reach up with a paw and start grabbing my arm and taking it away from the typing. Or another cat, the current cat that I have now, that lives with me now, likes to take things off my desk. If she comes and asks for attention, she gives me plenty of chances to respond. And when I don't, she takes things off my desk and starts shredding them and chewing them. And they can be like the bill from the insurance company or the, you know. So I've learned that I can offer attention, that other beings sometimes need attention, and that I can make the choice to offer it to them as a gift, you know. So if I just give my cat, you know, a couple of minutes of just being with her, that usually does the trick. So, paying attention. Our precepts talk about doing and not doing. The first three, the three pure precepts, cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others. That's all about doing, and the first one of them is about stopping. So that's about not necessarily doing, but about ceasing from evil. And evil in Buddhism, I like to think of as something that causes harm, not something that's a sort of inherently bad in a judgmental way of this is evil. It's something that causes harm to self or others. So to stop doing that, stop, you know, doing that which you are which you know has the potential for causing harm. And you know that through your meditation. Writers and musicians sometimes talk about omissions. That is what one leaves out of a piece of writing or a piece of music, which is as important or more important than what's actually in there. I took a lot out, believe it or not. I took quite a bit out of this talk before giving it. So, the second pure precept, do only good, is talking about cultivating behaviors that lead to liberation. And we have a good specific example, the paramitas, or perfections, generosity, perceptual behavior, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. So those are all things we can do during the course of our day. Under the umbrella of doing only good, those are all practices that we can actually do. They aren't ideas that come from a book. They're practices to use in our daily life. Just take one, patience. Do you ever have an opportunity to use patience in your daily life? How many each day, you know? So there's something we can do. What to do? Practice patience. And I say practice because it takes a llot of practice and encourage you not to be too impatient with yourself in practicing patience. It doesn't happen right away. So there's a lot of helpful teaching what to do. And the third pure precept, do good for others, that's been a little tougher for me. And so it helps me to sometimes refer to, in the Dhammapada, this is stated as to purify one's mind. Cease from evil, do only good, and purify one's mind or one's heart. That helps me kind of avoid the trap of separating myself and others. Do good for others. Okay, what, you know. And helps determine what to do to help others. Helping others can be tricky. One monk who was a social worker before becoming a monk talks about a sign that was up in their office that said, "The helping hand strikes again." And we have numerous occasions of the helping hand striking again around the monastery when you live in any community or a workplace or a family. I'm sure the helping hand strikes there too. One puts down a book, for example, in a safe place because you have to go do something else and you're going to come back to it later. And when you come back to it, the helping hand is struck again because somebody has tidied up and put the book maybe back in the library, which is not a bad thing to do, you know. However, with a good intention, it's possible to try helping others, but maybe they don't need the help right at that moment. So the wise discernment of purifying one's heart, we can always do that, purifying one's mind. Okay, another teaching on doer and doing was from Great Master Dogen in the Kyoju Kaimon commentary on the third great precept, do not covet. Great Master Dogen's comment is the doer, the doing, and that which has the doing done to it are immaculate. Therefore, there is no desire. It's that last part that's very interesting. Therefore, there is no desire. The word desire is what brought me back to the Buddha's The Four Noble Truths, and the cause of suffering is grasping at the desires that come up for us, grasping at them like this. The opposite of grasping, by the way, is this, and what I'm doing now for anyone listening is I'm holding up a hand open with the palm facing upwards. This is grasping, either way, grasping. And not grasping. Opening is letting go. There's a wonderful book on meditation by the Japanese Soto Zen master of the last century, Uchiyama Roshi, called Opening the Hand of Thought. I love that description of what we do in meditation practice. Opening the hand, we're opening the hand of what we're thinking up here, meaning allowing it to arise and pass. Okay, so do not covet is sometimes stated as not to indulge in sexuality. That's good and helpful, and I think for me it's bigger than that, because for me it includes grasping after any desire. To covet means to grasp, and leading directly to suffering. Coveting or craving implies a feeling about oneself lacking in something, which is really a denial of the truth of the Buddha nature in all of us, feeling that we're lacking in something, and then seeking for it outside oneself and grasping those things we think might help us get it. So this desire and the suffering all come from ignorance, and we can open our hand of thought and our hand of doing and being, and just let the ignorance be and pass. Okay, so when asking the question what to do, one can be aware of what's behind the motivation. What is the motivation? And it's not too tough to be aware of this, especially in, you know, sometimes it's subtle, other times it isn't. I mean, if you hear the word, when I hear the words, I want, I need, I must have. If I don't have, then something terrible will happen. If I do have, then something wonderful will happen. But when I hear those words of should and must and need, then I can stop and take a deep breath and go a little bit deeper. It's very easy to think about this for me in terms of food, because I love food, and you know, when I go through the food line and I see something, oh, I must have that. I hope that no monk in front of me takes the last piece of cake because I must have it, you know. Or I must have the biggest piece because I like that stuff, you know. That's a silly example, and it arises and we can practice with it. And it's not about food, but it's I must show that I'm this or that or the other thing. I must achieve this or that or the other thing in order to prove that I'm worthwhile. So when we see what to do, it helps to look, to sit still and look at what is the motivation. Is it should, must, need? Is there a sense of grabbing? A sense of hanging on? Is there a driven quality? our culture conditions us to be driven and to do, go. Is there that? Is that, are we feeling that when we're asking what to do? I must do this, I must do that. There's a little story that I ran into in a version of the Dhammapada that gives the stories of how the little verses came about. And this was an interesting little story, very short. It said, a monk was always sweeping the rooms in the monastery. However, an arahant came along and advised the monk to practice meditation, and the monk realized the truth. That's the story. And what's wrong with sweeping the monastery? I mean, that could be a very wonderful thing to do. The story's a little sparse on details, but it suggests that perhaps the monk might have been not attending to their meditation practice and concentrating on doing these things that might, you know, make them look good, give them a good reputation for being a helpful person, whatever, but not doing their meditation practice. I don't know. That's, you know, it's not stated in the story. The verse that that led to in the Buddha's teaching is, who once did live in heedlessness, and now is heedless nevermore, illuminates the world like the moon freed from clouds. So, we can be heedful of what it is, what to do, be heedful of what we're doing, and our reason for doing it. So, the question of what to do, as it arises for me countless times throughout our days, I see as countless opportunities to put the teaching into practice, moving onwards in the cessation of suffering by letting go of grasping the self, of our habit energy, our conditioning, our constituent parts, if you were. This simple physical gesture of opening the hand helps me. The gesture of gassho, which is putting the hands together, helps me. Thinking of grasping as this, making a fist, is helpful. I don't understand how that works. It just does. And we each find our own ways of opening. They appear to us naturally in meditation, relying on the heart's aspiration. In the words of Great Master Dogen, when the Buddha does all and you follow this doing effortlessly and without worrying about it, you gain freedom from suffering and become yourself Buddha. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you.